Don't waste a second coding yet another login registration system. Use Product Structure to dynamically provide your site with turnkey solutions for user engagement, all through a single line of JavaScript. From registration to importing contacts to inviting friends, our products come with a built-in A/B testing engine to ensure you have the best methods to manage your users. Product Structure. Focus on your core application and let us serve you the rest.
Chatosaurus is live chat for teams that like to have fun and get stuff done. Mostly Erlang listeners get 10% off their first year of Chatosaurus in addition to the 30-day free trial. Go to chatosaur.us/register and enter the coupon code MOSTLYERLANG. Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Mostly Erlang podcast. Today we're going to talk about continuous integration and continuous deployment and tools to go around that. The release project topic will be covered on a future episode. Some of the people we were hoping to get to talk about that couldn't be with us today due to other commitments. So if you're expecting that, as it was announced on Twitter, sorry, we'll get that on a future week. So with us today, we have some of the usual suspects. We have Brian Hunter.
Hello.
Francesco Cesarini.
Hi there.
And new this week, we have Eric Merritt.
Hello.
And Torben Hoffman.
Hi there.
Torben, did I get your last name right?
Hoffman. Yeah.
Okay. Just always like to double check. So why don't we start with Eric and Torben introducing yourselves. You know, tell us where you guys are located and, you know, sort of, you know, what you do and what, you know, anything else of interest.
So I guess I can jump in and go first.
Yeah, go for it, Eric.
So currently I'm based in Seattle, Washington. I work for a company in California doing Erlang for the most part, distributed systems in Erlang. I've been doing Erlang since 99 or 2000, shortly after it was open source. And, you know, I've done tools in Erlang and been interested in the Erlang and part of the Erlang community for a long time. I'm also one of the co-authors of the book Erlang and OTP in Action. And I've had a long history relevant to this topic of being interested in build processes and development processes and things like continuous integration, continuous deployment, and how those work into the development process itself. So this should be an interesting topic for me, at least.
And Torben, where are you located, and what do you do?
I'm located just north of Copenhagen.
Okay.
And I work for Erlang Solutions, and I've just gotten a new role and title there, CTO. I've been with Erlang Solutions for a year, where I've been working with as product and research manager. My background with Erlang starts in 2006, where while I was working for Motorola, I got the fantastic idea to say, let's do something in Erlang. And then, being the arch enemy of Ericsson, it was kind of awkward to introduce an alien technology, but it succeeded. And we actually ended up shipping a product, which I know from my old colleague who's still working with them, they're going to make it into the, not a beta product, but a real product. And they're actually going to staff up a team of 25 engineers in St. Petersburg doing a shitload of Erlang to get this done. So that, I think that's a pretty good success story.
Yeah, and
congratulations. That's a CTO Erlang Solutions.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the pinnacle you can get within the Erlang community.
Yeah. Pretty much.
As we usually say, we promote people to the level of their incompetence.
weren't you the prior CTO?
Sorry?
Francesco, weren't you the CTO before this?
I was CTO until 2009, okay. When those people came on board, yeah.
What's your title now?
Technical director.
Technical director.
General troublemaker.
General troublemaker. I want that on my business card. General troublemaker. So before we get into the topic, there are a couple things to promote. First coming up is Erlang Camp in Nashville. Brian, can you just give us a quick word about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So Erlang Camp, and Eric can probably jump in on this one as well, because he'll be being a professor there. I'm doing the legwork in Nashville. I'm out of Nashville. And, so Erlang Camp will be coming to Nashville, Tennessee, October 11th and 12th. This is a Friday, Saturday event, and it is the very best way to level up in Erlang. Wherever your skill level is, you can come in and come out of it 2 days later brighter. And just a great event. I went in 2010, and it just blew my mind. And so I've been every time I'd see Eric at a conference or run into any of the people, I'd bug him on Twitter, bug him wherever to like, when are you going to come to Nashville for an Erlang camp? And so they finally took me up on it. And so we have a great venue for it. We've got a great city for it. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Nashville quite a lot. Basically, our goal with Erlang camp is to shove as much information specifically about how to design large systems using OTP into folks' head as we can in 2 days' time. So it's workshop style. We don't go into tremendous depth on any one thing, but we touch on just about everything enough so that you understand what's going on and you know where to go look when you run into a problem or an issue or if you need some functionality that that you don't know about. So it tends to be a very intense couple of days.
Sounds like it. And Francesco, we have Erlang Factory Lights coming up, four of them. So why don't you give us a rundown on that?
There are quite a few. So starting off with New York City, the first factory light there. And that's going to be on the 14th of September, a Saturday. And we're lucky to have Joe Armstrong giving the keynote. We're also giving Erlang courses in conjunction with the factory light. And it's Robert Berning, another co-inventor of Erlang, teaching those. So, you know, lots of great people and names speaking. October 4th, so I think right before Nashville, just to get you warmed up and all excited, we've got the Chicago Erlang factory light. And even there, you know, we've got a long lineup of really, really good speakers. We've got Alex Gunaris, Garrett Smith, Adam Denberg from the Huffington Post, and many, many others. We also are organizing the first factory light in Berlin, October 16th. And we've got Joe Armstrong even there keynoting. We've got Steve Vinovsky and another amazing lineup of speakers. And finally, for those who like nice Mediterranean climate, Tel Aviv on the 23rd of October on the Google campus.
Yeah.
So very, very intensive kind of fall.
The Tel Aviv one, by the way, will be, first of all, it's going to be free. So obviously you will have to pay to get to Tel Aviv if you're coming from outside of Israel. Talks will be in a combination of English and Hebrew. And the call for proposals is still open. So if you'd like to give a talk at that, you can go onto the webpage or just contact me, and it should be great. And if anybody is coming to Israel for that and would like to do some touring, drop me a line, and I can probably introduce you to somebody, a friend, point you to some useful directions, or even introduce you to a friend of mine who's a tour guide. So, but it should be a great conference. They should hopefully all be great conferences, but I get a special vested interest in Tel Aviv because that's, you know, where I am. So, cool. We've got Erlang stuff coming up all, you know, all over the place. We're spawning conferences here. Sorry.
As long as it's not spawn link, that would be a disaster.
Well, things go wrong, yeah.
Yeah. One of them crashes and they take the whole conference network down with them. That would be bad. Unless the supervisor just restarts the conference.
Yeah.
All right. I think we've milked this joke for all we can. So, all right, continuous integration and continuous deployment. Let's start with the CI side of it. Are people doing who's doing what with CI? We have a Jenkins server, sort of. Eric, why don't you sort of lead off on that front?
CI in Erlang is pretty much like CI and everything else. Default assumption that built, and that build system has the ability to run your common test, unit, or other testing suite. Then you're kind of gorgeous on, you're kind of golden on CI. Jenkins is going to run it, it's going to test, and you're good. Now, the interesting thing comes up when you want to do like more integration or release style testing, where you want to bring up your entire release and run tests against it. And that's, Jenkins will still handle that and still handle it quite well. It just takes a little bit more setup work on your part. But again, extremely approachable.
Yeah, I've actually had Jenkins set up to run Dialyzer as well. And
let's just say if your build does not run Dialyzer by default, you're doing it wrong.
Well, I had it set up, and I'm not sure this is the right way, but I actually set it up that the unit tests and Dialyzer were running in separate Jenkins jobs.
Okay.
But it was running both. Unfortunately, at the time, our code base was separated between two Git repos, and I merged them together, and unfortunately, since I've merged them, there are about four or five Dialyzer bugs I just haven't quite gotten out yet, mostly because they're in modules that I'm planning to rewrite in the near future, and I just didn't see the need to go in and rip them apart.
Only so in my project, like the default build, the thing that happens when you type make or whatever, runs all of your tests and all of Dialyzer as well. And then if you want to do something different, you have to do more, right? You have to do make, compile, or something along those lines. That way, it's really hard to forget to run your tests and run Dialyzer before you commit any code. And generally, we have the requirement that you cannot commit code. Code never makes it through a review unless it, of course, passes all the Dialyzer and passes all of the unit tests. And that's like kind of the minimal quality stuff that any project, any non like playing around project should implement.
Right.
No, Eric, you have a make file. I saw a blog post on about it. It sort of sits up above Rebar and kicks off a whole chain of things. You have a good post on this. Would you mind posting a link to that?
No, not at all.
Because it's a really handy one to know. Yeah, it's helped me.
I'll go dig it up. Give me a second.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, one thing I'm sort of realizing is that the proper way to do testing is sort of in layers. So I have some tests in eUnit. I have some tests, some stuff in Dialyzer. I don't have anything with QuickCheck yet or with Proper, but I probably will at some point so we can figure it out. And then I've got some integration tests that actually test my API from a, you know, from CURL that I need to automate. And there'll be some Selenium tests as well that can test everything. And, you know, hopefully between all of those you get a significant code coverage. CI seems pretty straightforward.
What are the so we've listed a lot of just names of tools that people hook into their build process and their continuous integration, but could we come up with a nice catalog of so you'd have like I guess you so we have Dialyzer that's been talked about. Does anyone hook in any sort of profiling as part of any sort of profiling in before you kick off tests, or anyone doing anything like that with eProf or cProf or anything? Or
no? Not eProf. We've got coverage analysis. So, I mean,
so you're using cover, the built-in cover? Or okay, so the cover right, module.
As a standard, just to get some you know, high-level overview and idea.
Costas did a talk a couple of years ago about some of the tools. It seems like his group in Athens and Uppsala is building all sorts of cool tools for Erlang. They seem to really have, you know, a handle on that, doing some cool stuff between Dialyzer, Proper, and Typer, some
there's
of the
other. The cross-reference.
Yeah, you can really get, you know, a lot of mileage out of those.
I think that doing profiling as part of CI, I think the maturity level you have to be at is well, beyond most of us. And
yeah, profiling as part of CI doesn't seem really worth it because
unless you have some very very specific SLAs you need to adhere to, but even then, it that's really pushing it there because it's very hard to get a yes no answer out. That you can use to slap people over their fingers with.
I don't want my CI system to sort of say, oh, well, maybe that's a problem. You know, as you say, it needs to be a yes-no thing. And performance testing is a really important thing, but
it's a specific thing. It's something you do once you see there's a problem, right?
Or
like, oh, we're having performance problems on this particular axis. Let's go figure out why we're having that performance issue.
You could see, like, do you have some sort of ghost that keeps coming back? So, I would think of like if you had particular things, this would be more like a acceptance test level, you know. So you have something that you know if you kick this off, you know. So it probably means you don't really understand exactly where the problem is, but it could be another, you know, just another gap.
Well, I was working on a script earlier. I didn't quite get it done yet. Probably this week. Using R to look at the web machine performance log. And basically the idea is I want to just take my, you know, I have a script that runs overnight or whatever that takes my previous day's performance logs, goes through, takes for each, each interface module, tells me what's the average time it takes, request time, and what's the sort of 95th percentile percent time, and gives me a nice little graph of them so that, you know, I can just, as well as perhaps how often are they called, so I can just have a, you know, an indication of, oh, look, this one over here is being really slow, and it's getting called a lot. I should do something about that. You know, because the problem is you don't necessarily know that in testing. You know, it could be the problem is that, you know, an SQL statement is taking a long time once you have performance data, you know, once you're on a loaded system with performance data, which you wouldn't necessarily know from a test system, unless your test systems are set up a lot better than mine are.
Let's get a link to the tools from the Athens group, if we can. I think that's going to be really useful.
Yeah.
And I want to point out that that Concurrex makes a – they're not really profiling tools. They're more like system analysis tools that are really, really interesting. Not something you could work into your build process, I don't think, but certainly some interesting tools to know about.
Yeah. So there's a presentation Costas did a couple of years ago. I'll put a link in the show notes to the slides. And it was at Erlang Factory in, say, 2009. But the title was Cool Tools for Modern Erlang Programming Development, and it goes through Tidier and a lot of others. And I think he's got more. Let's just see if I can find the link.
I know that in the fall we will have a webcast on some tooling as well. Jesper Lewis will... I don't know if he will ramble in that webcast, but at the very least he'll be talking about things. And one of the things I know he will be talking about is to set up what's the metric tool? I can't remember it now. But he's using a usage count on an existing legacy application, and then he's plotting metrics, and every time he has something in production where they haven't used the function for a while, he chucks it out.
Hmm.
So it's just a metric-driven way to kill dead code. But that'll be something he'll be talking about in the webcast this autumn.
That's gorgeous. Like, one of my favorite things is to see see pull requests that actually remove more code than they add, and having a reasonable way to do that. Extremely interesting.
Yeah. I can't find the specific link to Costas's group. It's got to be here somewhere, but I don't know where it is.
So that path was like looking at dead code, and then also, is anyone sweeping code to see if folks are using sort of forbidden functions, forbidden functions on forbidden method modules? Any sort of analysis of the code as a check? Anyone doing anything along that line?
Aside from deprecation, is there any way to do that with existing tools?
Exactly. I mean, I'm thinking what's going to happen if you start doing that? Programs will find ways around it and start using metaprograms.
Right. Yeah. Right. I was wondering, like, maybe through XRef or something like that. Yeah, but anyway, that's just an idea that popped in my head and probably not worth spending 30 minutes on this.
Yeah, I mean, those things too, is you can mark a type opaque, and then if it's only needs, you know, used in one module, and then if you try to use it anywhere else or pattern match on it or whatever, Dialyzer will complain at you. Apparently it's found all sorts of interesting bugs.
But, you know, before we actually started even recording, Torben had a really great comment, and that was, I guess, what led us to pick this topic for today, and that was the sort of the hell of releases and how continuous integration, like, well, if you go from just doing the releases that people look at as being scary, and you make it like a constant thing, you do this continuous integration, then you take a lot of the fear out of it. I'd love to hear Torben talk a bit about that thought there.
Because one of the things I've tried in a big system has been to have a Jenkins-driven continuous deployment. But then again, continuous deployment with I don't know how many quotation marks you want to put around it, because all it ever did was that... it took down the existing code and put in the new release. There was no release upgrade in any way. So, and I think from what I've been able to dig up, that that is the way most people, they do their continuous deployment. They just shut off a server and put in the new release, and then they run with it. There's no release upgrades or even anything happening to a large extent there.
That's always a cost-benefit analysis you need to do on it, because live upgrades aren't cheap.
Yeah, I was about to say the exact same thing, Francesco. Like, I recommend that people start with that exactly approach. That's the approach we use. Because getting hot upgrades right is, like Francesco just said, extremely expensive. And if you design your systems well, which I mean you should be designing your cluster with the ability to lose nodes at arbitrary moments and not affect the running of your system. If you do that, then the hot upgrades become much less interesting than they are in other situations, in say like a telephony switch. Right. Or in a situation where you're vertically scaling and that vertically scaled node cannot go down. In those cases, you definitely want to do it. But in the vast majority of cases, it's way too expensive for what you get from it.
Right. I mean, it sounds like, especially using something like React Core, which again, we're going to have a future episode on at some point, where you can, as you say, add and remove pieces. You know, if you just take your ring of your bunch of nodes and you just sort of add a new node with the new software on it, and then, you know, as you know, get those up and running, test them, and then take the new ones out, and then switch your load balancer over or whatever, depending on how you have it set up, that can work quite nicely.
There's still plenty of caveats with that, right? So you've got to worry about protocol versioning and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Service versioning and, you know, all the kind of stuff you normally have to worry about. But those are much more tractable problems, especially if you think about them from the get-go, than hot code upgrading is.
Right. I mean, the real place you run into problems is things like if you change the fields in a record, well, that goes back to the opaque type.
Yeah.
Types that make that easier. You make sure that those fields are only referenced in one place, at least.
I mean, the biggest challenge we've had is non-backwards compatibility when you're actually upgrading in distributed environments.
Right, where you...
Yeah, sure.
If a record... Had,
yeah.
An interface changes or a record changes, and, you know, you have some stuff, the old stuff, and it just goes...
Yeah. Record changes within a node are fairly straightforward if you know what processes are using the constructs.
Right.
Because, you know, you've got a code change function you just call where you do those changes, but it can be a costly operation as well if you need to traverse a whole media table.
Yeah, we've taken ownership of the in most of our systems. Most of this I've done recently in the system I'm working on now. We've taken ownership of communication away from the distributed relying layer and implement it ourselves, and do things like explicit service versioning, explicit protocol versioning, and kind of have that managed in the platform layer, which is actually quite easy to do in Erlang. And that allows us to have fairly easy fallback on service versions and this kind of stuff. But again, it's something that you need to think about as you're designing your system or getting started with your system. Otherwise, it's going to really bite you in the butt when you have a production system that you're trying to upgrade in stages. You're trying to roll out your continuous deployment, right?
Yeah. And then, of course, you have the options of doing things like, you know, the Heroku approach where you deploy code by simply pushing stuff to a Git repo. You push stuff to Git into your Git repository, and then your server says, oh, look, there's new code. I should do something. And, you know, takes it and just deploys it automatically.
Yeah, so that segues over to a slightly separate topic, right, which is getting your code on the production boxes. As opposed to rather than upgrading your code on upgrading your node in place, like two separate concerns. One depends on the other, but the getting your code onto the box does not actually depend on the your new thing you've created being able to talk to the other things. And actually, getting your code onto the box is actually somewhat interesting from a deployment perspective.
But the sort of getting your code onto the box, there are a couple of options. You can do a direct pull from GitHub. You could build it into an Erlang release or some other package, like an RPM or a deb file, whatever. What other options do people have, do people use?
Well, I'm a fairly strong
Can you repeat that? You dropped out for a minute.
Sorry. I said I'm kind of a bigot when it comes to this topic.
Yeah, I mean, currently what we're doing is you're simply doing a pull from GitHub onto the server.
All right, sorry about that, guys.
So it's probably not the approach I want to stick with, but it's so far.
Eric could just let in with he's a bigot.
Yeah.
Yes, I am. I'm a horrible bigot. No, I have very strong opinions when it comes to bits so much in the past by it. So let's take the first thing is that you need to take versioning seriously. It can't be an afterthought. You need monotonically increasing version numbers that mean something. Being able to manage your stuff in the context of your environment is really important. So what I mean by that is like you're probably using some form of Unix or Linux. That form of Unix or Linux has some kind of a package system. Like, yeah. Use that. There's all kinds of tools that work with that. It automatically takes versioning easy. It takes versioning seriously. And with tools like FPM, which I can't recommend strongly enough, it's really easy to create native packages. What we do basically is when we do our build and it successfully tests in various layers and all that kind of thing, build system uses FPM to create a native package. In our case, we're deploying to CentOS, so that's an RPM. We deploy that RPM to an RPM server. That RPM server detects the change, looks, and we use Ansible to actually do deployment. And I'll paste the link to Ansible. I can't recommend that enough either. And then it kicks off the relevant Ansible deployment script to deploy that particular RPM. And that actually works really, really well. And everyone understands the concepts in place. And it took a little work to get to figure all this out, right? To be able to learn how to build RPMs or devs or what have you. And then to get the Erlang release, into something that fits nicely in Unix. And I'm not to call out, things here, but a lot of the kind of open projects out there that people depend on, and I won't call any names, do a really poor job of integrating into Unix, of having like standard, Unix start and stop scripts and initd, being able to work under things like daemon tools. And granted, it's hard, but to do that, you live in that existing Unix environment, it opens up a world of kind of understandable possibilities to you.
Right. Do you know of any good tutorials on how to build those?
You know what? I've not seen those out there, but I've got them internally at my company, and I expect very strongly that I could take them and do a little and put them out, and I'll try to do that over the next couple of days.
Oh, thanks. If you do that, send me links and I'll put them in the show notes.
True.
Eric, it would be great if you could actually add them, so a shameless plug in here, on the wiki on Erlang Central, where we currently have migrated all of the Trapexit tutorials, because
sure,
we've got the largest collection now of tutorials there.
Sure, I can.
Really cool if you added them there.
I can do that without any at all.
Most of the stuff there is also yours from the days where you're porting the cookbook as well.
Oh, okay.
Days, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like there's some good stuff. Yeah, I'm not sure if I want to use the... I'm not sure whether I want to use the idea of... I like the idea of having it automatically build the RPM. I'm not entirely sure I'm comfortable with the idea of it deploying, you know, installing them automatically.
That's continuous deployment, right?
Right.
It's rolling out and updating your stuff. If you stop at just the building and you've got to manually update them. And so let's make a very clear distinction between just running like a yum install or an apt-get install and running a deployment tool like Ansible or Puppet or Chef or something along those lines. When I'm talking about installing them, I'm talking about running a tool. In our case, it's Ansible, but whether it's Ansible or Puppet or Chef, that's what I'm talking about.
Right. Where you have actually something that's sort of managed and has some real properties like, I'm not familiar with Ansible, but I'll go look it up.
That's exactly it. Where you have something that's going to do any kind of configuration that needs to happen. Ensure, you know, all the stuff that comes up with an automated installation. Not the RPM just becomes the unit of installing your package, right? And your package, in our case, is an Erlang release. And I recommend strongly that it always be a self-contained Erlang release that includes ERTs and includes all of its dependencies and these kinds of things. It becomes complex and messy when you try to like build a package for each of your individual OTP applications and have Erlang in a separate package. When the Erlang release system does all that for you, kind of out of the box, so it becomes really trivial to wrap up a release packs up a release into an RPM or a DEB or what have you, and manage that release.
Yeah, it's sounds like you want just one RPM that it just goes.
You know, I've been thinking on this, all the way to the deployment is maybe being something that's more important with Erlang than it is with most languages. I'm thinking of a system, systems that run for years, and maybe the developers have been gone for 2 years, and this I've witnessed, like a system that had been running for 4 years, 2 years before there had been a deployment, and then since then the developers hadn't been around, and so this code was up and running, everything's using it, and so at that point, people have even forgotten that they have Erlang running in their infrastructure. And so it's up and a node goes down, it does some self-healing, deploys to another node. The code can run, but without having the operational sort of reminder of continuous integration, you can shift environment around that might break something. And at that point in the life cycle, maybe no one has the knowledge of even how to build or whether, and so if you have something as formal as continuous integration around it, it maybe is even more important here than it would be in, say, a Java or a .NET or, a Python or whatever project.
Well, the other thing I was going to say is the one thing that we sort of been looking at is, we have a, config file that we use, a standard Erlang config file that we use to configure our app. Because database information, stuff like that in it. What's the best way to sort of hold on to those? Because I don't want it in our general Git repository. I thought about putting it in a separate, in a gist or a separate Git repo that you just have a shell script that checks it out and symlinks the appropriate thing. And then start before you start up Erlang, what other, approaches have people taken to that, to having the config file separately versioned from the
Hopefully you're running your, and I'm jumping in here again, hopefully you're running your release as part of your development process on a regular basis, right? So you need some kind of local to your release, probably committed under the same repository as your release, right? That you use regularly for development.
If you guys are going to type, can you just please mute your microphones? It's going to come through really loudly.
But however, when it comes to your deployment, that config is part of your deployment stuff. And like I said, I massively encourage you to use Puppet Chef or Ansible or some similar thing. And all of those configurations are in its own separate repo, right? And that's going to include the configuration changes for your installed Erlang release.
Right.
Do you have a separate application which just handles configuration, which is a layer on top of OTP's environment variables, Eric?
So it depends on what you're talking about. So there's always some like sys.config for Erlang release, right? You don't have to have one, but there's usually in almost every case some basics there. So we absolutely use that to set up some defaults. And then internally, we do a lot of dynamic configuration in our release, right? Figuring out what services to start, where they should be started, and all that kind of stuff, a static config. That's just part of the living, running environment in which that particular OTP app exists. So that's, I consider that a separate concern than that initial kind of sys.config and how that gets configured.
So you don't actually go in and change the application environment variables in that case once you've started?
Oh, no. I actually consider it fairly bad practice to, for the application variables to change after startup. Like if you need some, and for the same reason I don't like the idea of like variables changing on me on the fly. Like that initial config, I want to know where to go and get those app config values, and I want to know where to change them. If you need other things that are dynamically changing, like we almost always use some kind of internal app to handle that.
Yeah.
In our case, we have a internal app that kind of keeps a world view of the entire cluster locally. And you can go to that to ask that information about dynamically changing values. But I really don't like the idea of doing an application set ENV at all.
What sort of lifetime are you talking about though? If something is running for a very long time, So would the environment variables you're talking about that wouldn't be changing, not be changing how often? do you know what I'm getting at?
I think I understand what you're saying. And let me give you guys the thing that I'm just giving you I try to build my systems, in my opinion. Uh-huh. So in my system, application ENVs come from either the sys.config or in very few cases, the .app file, right?
Yeah.
And if I get a system dot, if I get an environment value from that, I want to be able to say, okay, you know, I got this environment value. Let me go change it. So I know I got to go to sys.config or I know I got to go to the dot app if it's not in the sys.config. And like in my systems, I push back really hard on having environmental variables in the dot app files. I think that's just bad practice as well. So I always know where that comes up. It becomes a real nightmare when you have things randomly changing the application environment from kind of arbitrary places. So you get a value like, oh my God, what's this value? And you have no idea where it's coming from. What you end up doing is you end up grepping your code base for application set ENV and trying to figure it out, right?
So, and this is assuming somebody didn't go into a terminal and just set it manually.
That's exactly it. Well, in my deployed systems, there's no SSH access. No one can even do that. It's all the continuous deployment system handles it all.
Oh, come on, Eric. Come on, Eric. You live in America. You have a backdoor. Come on. Admit to it.
So my backdoor is to nuke the box that's having problems and deploy a new one.
Yeah, but do you have a way to do like profiling on a live system between you two?
So when we needed to do profiling, we bring up a again, because our entire configuration system is automated, it's fairly trivial for us to bring up a lot of like a similarly configured live system, not live system, but similarly configured system, and then run test it against that system, right? But I do not encourage in my world, I do not encourage like SSHing onto a living running box and starting to futz around with it.
The other question I had was, you know, it seems like when you're setting up Erlang, the default is, you know, you use NetADM ping or whatever to sort of knit your various nodes together. And of course, that works better if you know what all the addresses are in advance, which of course, if you're running on EC2 or something, you don't, because, you know, servers are kind of, they come and go. The IPs you get are kind of random. So sort of what's a good way to sort of say, okay, here's a global view of what nodes are in my cluster. I'm bringing up a new one. How do I hook it up? You know, how do I connect it? What's, you know, how do people handle that one?
We're currently writing kind of a generic operation, a maintenance node, which will do exactly this. So, you know, there's nothing which is Erlang specific right now. There are more generic tools, but... the whole monitoring side has been an area where, you know, everyone has rolled out their own solution or used non-Erlang specific ones.
You know, whereas, I mean, I think for one thing, you can actually provide an EC2 node if you're using Amazon. There's a config file that you can give it a, you know, sort of environment variables when you start the node up and then access them by calling a web address or something, and it'll just be able to read them in. So if you just gave it a, you know, some config files, some config variables of the, you know, another node on the cluster is here. Go, you know, go announce yourself that would work. But
so for us, we don't actually use Erlang's distribution layer at all because of limitations like that. We actually have a fairly well-defined membership protocol implemented based on a kind of an old paper, but interesting paper called Dimple 2. Where you just need to connect one node with another node, and that will run some interesting algorithms to provide a membership into the cluster. So you just have to know where one other node is and do that connection. And that actually should be open source before too much longer.
Well, I mean, the whole Erlang, you know, node interconnect, you know, once you have a network of nodes, once you add another node in, it pretty quickly knows about every other node in the cluster that's not hidden. So, again, you just need to know about one other one, and the others are just going to sort of follow by automatically.
Well, I mean, those who've solved that problem have, you know, occasionally had subclusters and then connected them together using hidden nodes or, you know, so-called gateways. But it is an overhead you really don't want to deal with. especially if you're writing, you know, for scalability and going to have, you know, thousands of Erlang nodes in your cluster.
Yeah.
You know, but as Eric says, you know, we rolled the first time we bypassed Erlang distribution and started rolling out our own distribution mechanism was 2007. And that was, you know, a cluster about 30, 40 nodes.
I mean, were they still talking through the Erlang wire protocol or were they actually like?
No, TCP/IP sockets. And, you know, that allowed us to add a layer of security on top of it. It added us to, it facilitated adding of load balancing algorithms and also kind of redundancy in case one node goes down, it was automatically rerouted to another node. So,
I mean, could you at that point send a message between two processes or did you have to sort of?
It was all RPC based, so it wasn't sending messages, no.
So it was basically, you basically at this point have, as far as Erlang is concerned, 30 independent nodes and then just there's a higher level protocol.
So that is correct. There were a few of these nodes which were nodes of the same type, which were connected using distributed Erlang. And, you know, they were sharing some easier tables, but, you know, I think the largest cluster had three nodes of the same type. And so, you know, we weren't running into any of these issues.
Right.
We've basically done the exact same thing as Francesco has done. Kind of ripped out not used the Erlang distribution layer and, done our own. And then we're talking, believe it or not, we're talking right now JSON over HTTP and a REST-like system, which has the same result that Francesco had with the nice kind of addition that introducing non-Erlang stuff into the cluster becomes pretty trivial.
Right.
From our end, we just didn't want to add any overheads. And so it was TCP/IP and just, you know, we did a term to binary and then, you know, through and then decoded on the other end just for speed.
Right. So,
with Global Group, you know, basically setting up partitions, is that a route that you all went through before getting there? Of course, we're two or three steps away from continuous integration now, but this is a good conversation. Using that to basically break up into partitions so you wouldn't have the chatter?
I've never seen it used. So they're basing SD Erlang, standard distributed Erlang, in the release project, but I personally have not seen it used. I mean, it's possible many of our clients are using it, but I've not come across it.
So how
I haven't either, for that matter. Nor have I seen anyone using it.
If you had a 20-node cluster just using distributed Erlangs, how much cross-chatter would there be? I mean, how much of an issue is it?
It wouldn't be an issue. You can set the the timeout values and, you know, the frequency at which, you know, they ping each other. So 20 nodes is not an issue.
I've heard the rule of thumb is it like 64 nodes or 32 or 64 nodes when the guidance was like at that point set up global group partitions. But that's interesting. I've goofed around with this a little bit. But I don't know if I'm not using it for anything I have to use it for. I'm just kind of playing. So it might be a fun exercise to go ahead and take this play to something bigger and then just like, you know, have a proof of it. You know, it's like it works or it doesn't work. But I'm sure that I'd be surprised if it doesn't work at a large scale.
The whole idea of a fully connected graph, which arguably is kind of what an Erlang cloud is, kind of disturbs me at a fundamental level. So
Eric, we are all connected.
Yeah. Wasn't that a cell phone ad?
No node is an island,
Eric.
We're all not connected
to each other. So I've actually never played with more than a few nodes. And like literally when I say a few, like three or four nodes in Erlang, whenever I've gone through to develop a system, I expect to grow large. And the current system, I expect to be eventually in the thousands or even the tens of thousands of nodes.
I have a research project.
What's that?
I've got a research project. It's funny because I had done this path off of I wasn't sure how too seriously to take that side of things until Erlang Camp, funny enough. And then the answer to a question earlier about, you know, what you do about having all these folks know about each other. And well, you know, you have a DNS name. You'd have a common name that you would just, you know, you'd do round robin and have two or three nodes that would be sitting there. That could take that ping, and so that was the solution that I think Martin pitched out as a good solution. So I kind of put that in my head, and I've been playing around with the global group stuff, even though I don't really need it at this point. It's just I've been kind of hoping for the day when I would need it. But this is funny.
Yeah, my big future move is I'm hoping someday need React Core to, you know, start doing some serious, you know, building our system up to a 5-node cluster, but we don't have the traffic that justifies a 5-node cluster. I just hope we do in 6 months.
But there's also another thing to keep in mind here, that although one can sit and marvel at what you can do with distributed Erlang and you can hook things up together quite nicely, most systems, they're not symmetric. They're asymmetric. So you don't want everybody to talk to everybody. In those systems, you want to control who talks to who.
This is true.
And then, as Francesco said, the moment you step away from using distributed Erlang, you get the benefit of you can add in security on things, and then you can mix and match your system to whatever needs you're having.
Hmm.
I mean, it'd be nice. I mean, the nice thing with distributed Erlang is, of course, that it's pre-built. You know, you don't have to add anything to it. Whereas if you're doing, you know, a homebrew system with your, you know, you're just doing it over sockets or whatever, then you have to sort of construct it yourself to figure it all out.
And that's really valuable. My rule of thumb is that you do the prototyping in distributed Erlang, and then when you get to make your real system, you switch it over to something else.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll second that, Eric, because if I try to rewind my feelings now and the arguments we had at Motorola, had I proposed I will just chuck away these TCP things and we'll just use distributed Erlang like to talk between the boxes, they would have had more than just my liver on a stick. This is really something that where it's a lot better to prototype first and then decide on a protocol that matches the problem later on. And then in most cases, it won't be distributed Erlang. You need to come up with something real.
Yeah, I'm looking at our system, and our system is basically running right now as a test mode on one node. And I'm seeing that, you know, 6 months from now, it might be running on 3 or 4 nodes, but probably it'd be 3 or 4 web nodes talking to a React cluster behind them. And those 3 or 4 nodes probably will be running 99% of the time at least, or 99% of what they're doing probably will not be distributed Erlang. It'll just talk directly to React, using React to do everything. And, you know, they might have some distributed between them just for some one or two little things, but I can't imagine.
So just don't fall into the trap of using React as a communication layer, right? It's a data store with semantics geared to a data store, not a distributed messaging layer. And that's actually an easy trap to fall into.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few go down that route and then, you know, basing everything on React Core, and then they don't have the flexibility all of a sudden when they need to take everything a step forward. So it's great for certain use cases, but not for very generic ones.
Yeah, you know, the React database, it's a database, and you should use it as such. You know, if you need a communications layer, you want something like RabbitMQ or something like that, or depending on what the communications you're doing.
Don't call point-to-point communication. I generally design my systems around some kind of robust, for lack of a better name, like DNS system, right? Usually through some kind of epidemic protocol, and then actual point-to-point communication through at everywhere else, and that actually tends to be extremely robust and pretty simple to understand too. So I'm not saying use that. I'm saying like don't think you have to have something like RabbitMQ or AMQP or something doing your messaging for you.
Again, it just depends on what you're trying to do. But you're right.
I'm curious. What were rules of thumb? Because I hear not exactly a holy war, but I do hear like there are very strong opinions about I connect everything with Rabbit, and then it's like, oh, I don't use Rabbit. And just about the connection, is there a sensible set of rules of thumb that people would use about when you use it versus when you roll your own? What types of systems? This would be interesting guidance. I think a lot of people are asking these questions.
So I think that it's going to have a very, like, you're going to get a lot of opinions, right? I certainly have extremely strong opinions on that subject, and I can back them up with what I consider facts, but other people say, well, no, that's not, that doesn't mm-hmm. make sense for these and these reasons. So my rule of thumb is you want as few participants in the communication as possible. The fewer participants you have, the less likely one of those participants will fail, right? Mm-hmm. So if the absolute best case of communication is where you don't communicate. You just don't talk to anyone. You only have one thing that can fail.
That's called marriage, Eric. That's called marriage.
Exactly.
Hey, today's my ninth wedding anniversary, actually.
Oh, congratulations. Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
The second best thing is where two things are communicating. And that's actually the optimal thing. If you can have it where your, for lack of a better term, services are communicating directly with one another and there are no other participants in that communication stream, then only one of those two things can fail, and that's great. And only thing that can introduce latency is things that are directly in between that, depending on how they communicate, right? As soon as you start introducing something else, I'm not necessarily picking on Rabbit here, but mm-hmm. But I'm going to use that as an example. It doesn't really matter whether it's Rabbit or Lord forbid. It
could be a web server.
Or something else, right? Mm-hmm. But as soon as you insert something else between them, suddenly you have the ability to fail, and suddenly you have a significant introducer of latency between those things, right? So now you have a queue between us. So you have this kind of elasticity that will bring in a lot of determinism. Suddenly you have a broker. And yes, you can do failover with brokers and this kind of thing. But now you're adding more and more complexity between these two communicants. And any time you add complexity, you bring in to you bring in the opportunity for failure.
Right. I mean, so, it seems to me that if you're introducing something like RabbitMQ, and we're so far off topic of deployment now, but that's okay. Of RabbitMQ, there should be a specific reason for it. I mean, there are things for which it's the right solution. You know, if you need a buffered data transfer where you're sending process, thing A is sending something to process B, but process B isn't reliable, you know, or maybe it wants to come pick it up later in a batch job, then RabbitMQ might make sense, depending on the details, of course. But just to have it for the sake of
a big one for me is between Erlang and .NET code. So it's a really easy place to be able to put Erlang in a place, you know, where we can hit sweet spots there, without freaking out people and without having tight dependencies. And so you can have multiple implementations and multiple languages of the same thing and just have, you know, that implementation listening to a queue to take work off. And so there's a really good story there, but that's not necessarily the, even the path that we were talking about the sort of network overhead side of it or the adding additional, you know, in that case, it actually makes something possible that wouldn't be politically possible maybe. And in other cases, maybe it adds ops. Like Eric was saying, any piece of software you add into the thing, if something goes wrong, you have to figure out, was it this part or this part or this part that broke?
Right. So, I mean, it adds some cost. And the question, of course, is for any given application, does it add more benefit or more cost? If it's adding more cost than benefit, don't do it.
Welcome to the fundamental question of distributed systems.
Yep. or just political systems. I mean, you know, this could be more about politics than about technology.
It's a funny thing. Now, when you're talking about just setting up point to point, and so you've got your chunks of Erlang code, and you're talking through sockets here, are you adding – so other languages, other things coming in and communicating, are they acting as peers in this, or how does that process work? So how do you generally do that?
I'll tell you what we've done, and this may or may not generalize to a broader audience, right? But I've designed a couple of systems like this, and it tends to work very well. So you have obviously like service location information and maybe property information being distributed in a DNS-like way throughout the system, right? We tend to use epidemic protocols for this because it tends to be a very good fit, but it doesn't actually matter. And then usually we have something that is like in Erlang, we have a behavior that is something like Gen server that's geared towards services. In the current system, that service is geared around, in our case, JSON over HTTP. Fairly easy to change later, but if we do change it, get something more efficient, we can. It doesn't actually matter. So that's like a service in our system that can be communicated with other things. Now, when we bring in, say, a Python member to the system, it implements the same protocol. It obviously doesn't have access to this service behavior, but it implements something very, very similar. So it comes up, it plugs into this kind of DNS-like system, and then it becomes a first-class peer.
Okay.
Communicate with services as if it was anything else.
All right, guys, we've got to wrap this up. We've been going about an hour now, so why don't we get to the picks? Brian, why don't you start us off? Any cool links?
I think you could probably learn a lot by going to erlangcamp.com/Nashville. That would be a great link. That's my pick for the week.
Eric?
One other pitch. Maybe and click particularly on the VIP tickets. Then you get to spend a whole hour talking with Eric and Martin and Jordan. And there are, I think, 10 tickets available. Out of this group of listeners, you can probably get the first 10 win.
Eric, you got any good picks? Good
yeah. Ones? So my going back to the original conversation, is kind of a somewhat new discovery to me is the Concurrex tools. They are absolutely like worth it, and they're drop in for the most part, and they can make interesting like improvements to your system just by using them.
Yeah, I haven't started running them yet, but I probably will. So Francesco, you there?
Yeah, I've got more of a historic tool, and it's the first presentation which was given any event on Erlang and continuous integration. And it was Eric Steinman from, at the time he was CTO of Klarna, who did a talk at Erlang User Conference on, quality cruising, making Java work for Erlang. And initially, when I first read the title, I thought it was quality cursing, making Java for Erlang. And it's a really interesting, talk. And I'm posting the link to the slides on how basically they introduced continuous integration and what continuous integration gave them. And let's not forget Klarna today, I think, has in excess of about 100 Erlang developers and have a huge system. Right. The banking sector they're managing and monitoring.
Torben, you got any interesting?
I think I'll add to Francesco's. I was actually there when Eric Steinman presented that talk, and there was a guy there that an Italian guy that jumped from his chair and said, "What Java? What Java?" And then within 2 minutes, two or three people had sort of volunteered that they would rewrite this continuous deployment tool in Erlang. Yeah. So that was a funny one.
I wasn't the one saying why Java.
I was wondering.
It wasn't me, but
it wasn't Francesco. No. cool picks of the week. I think I'll have to pass on this one because I'm just back from summer vacation, and all the I've been on weather forecast sites and I've been on home improvement sites. So I think I'll refrain from passing out any links this week.
My pick this week is actually not Erlang. It's R, the pirate language, the statistical language for pirates. R. Sorry. I use Web Machine a lot, as people who listen regularly know. And it spits out these handy performance logs. And I started playing with this afternoon when I had some time waiting for somebody else to catch up. And in like 7 lines of R, which I cut and paste mostly from a blog, I was able to actually start getting some really cool graphs. So I think another 4 lines of code, and I will have a thing that'll show me like all sorts of useful stuff about my performance of my thing, of my Erlang code. And again, it's just reading in log files that are spit out. So you have this, again, nice buffering mechanism in between with just log files. And hopefully can tell me useful things like which bits are running slowly so I can figure out whether I need to fix them or not. R is kind of cool. And, you know, I haven't learned new programming language in a couple of years, so something I'm going to spend a little time playing with because I have so much spare time.
Thank you all. This has got my head going. I'm sure it will a lot of folks listening, too.